All right, I appreciate the opportunity to talk today. I wore my bug tie to be in solidarity with the entomologists. Very difficult for a plant pathologist to say that. But before I begin, I'd just like to acknowledge some people, especially Curtis Utley, who's a graduate student working with Whitney and me. He's been doing all the work. And Kathleen Alexander, who is the forester in Boulder County, who really kept up the pressure on us to keep working on this. It was very tempting just to blow her off and attribute all this to drought, but she was very persistent, and persistence paid off. I can kind of summarize everything by telling you that this is a really, really scary disease. I had the opportunity for my PhD to work on butternut canker, and Steve was talking about these various diseases that come along. And butternut canker has essentially eliminated butternut from our native stands. But this disease is as bad as butternut canker, and it's got an insect vector, which the butternut canker doesn't. So if I'm in Kansas or Nebraska, you better be worried, because this is a nasty one. I got involved in 2006 when Kathleen invited me down to take a look at these trees, and by this time we knew that the walnut twig beetle was involved with the decline, but things just weren't adding up. And when I first came down to look at these trees, we started peeling the bark off the trunk, and you've seen these pictures before, but I was shocked to find these large vertical cankers that were running from the ground up 3-6 meters up into the tree on one side of the stem. And I had seen something like this previously working back in Wisconsin and Kansas, and associated with black walnut. And there was a fungus called Fusarium solani that we had worked with at that time. And so immediately I tried to isolate, and I did pull out this fungus called Fusarium solani. Unfortunately, that kind of put the blinders on me, and it probably delayed any progress on this disease for about 6 months to a year, because I got so focused in on this Fusarium solani that I missed the important part of it. And it's amazing as scientists how we can get focused in on something that's comfortable to us and just miss the big picture. And it certainly happened to me on this one. I'll come back to these trunk cankers in a moment, because this is still sort of an enigma, what's happening here on the trunks. But let me move on. So what we were trying to do is those trunk cankers were only part of the symptomology, and things just weren't fitting with Fusarium solani as being the primary causal agent. And the reason for that is, if you take a look at the branches, and you've seen lots of pictures of this where the beetle galleries are, the discoloration surrounding that is not caused by Fusarium solani. And I tried to isolate Fusarium from this, and I tried for about 6 months to a year, and I could never pull the fungus out. I kept pulling out this other fungus. It was a white spored fungus that looked all the world like penicillium. Now, for those of you who have taken intro plant path or mycology, you know that penicillium is a common saprophyte. It's also a common storage mold, and it's a problem on produce. But it's never associated with cankers on woody plant material. And so at that time, I just kept saying, this is a contaminant, this is a contaminant. And for 6 months, I kept saying, this is a contaminant. But it finally became overwhelming that this fungus was involved. And I've got a series of pictures here to show you the progression. I also initially thought that this discoloration around the galleries was maybe just a wound response, but it's definitely not. You can see in the upper left-hand corner the discoloration around the gallery, and if you go clockwise, well, not clockwise, but on the upper right, there's a little bit more discoloration, even more discoloration on the lower left, and pretty soon you get these cankers coalescing to girdle the stem. I don't know if you can see it. I guess Is there a pointer? Oops. Oh, okay. Well, it's not a big deal. If, in the lower left-hand picture, you can see the in the, one of those galleries, a little white, crusty appearance. That's the fungus fruiting. And it's quite obvious when you peel this off that the fungus is very commonly fruiting in some of these galleries. There's an example right there. This is what the fungus looks like. It's called Geosmithia. And until about a year ago, I didn't even know that there was a genus called Geosmithia. It's an anamorphic fungus based on phylogenetic studies. It's very closely related to the Hypocreales and the Ascomycetes, but it doesn't have, as far as we know, a sexual state. So it's just reproducing asexually. It's a very a different type of fungus because it's an off-white to buff color in culture. It looks very much like a penicillium, as I mentioned, but penicillia are always kind of dark colored, dark green or brown in color. And it's also different in that it's a dry-spored fungus. Every other, well, not every other, but almost all the other fungi that are plant pathogens have sort of a matrix. They're formed in a matrix, and so they tend to adhere to the insects. It's sort of a sticky matrix. But this one, the dry spores, it's still kind of a question how these spores are adhering to the insect body. There is one form of this fungus that we call a synanomorph that has sort of a sticky or liquid a matrix, but we've only seen this in culture and we haven't seen it on the twigs themselves. And you've seen a lot of pictures of this. This again is what the fungus looks like sporulating. It has a multi-branched head, barrel-shaped conidia, and it has what we call these varicose bumps on the conidiophore. And if I have to sit through entomology sessions where you talk about hairs on the tarsi, you're going to have to bear with me, and so you can see the bumps on the conidiophores. This group, there are seven named species, but it's even more complicated than that. Miroslav Kolarik, who does most of the work on this, is assigned different what he calls taxonomic units. Basically, we're not sure about the taxonomic status of some of these strains that he's collected. So the taxonomy of this group is somewhat in flux. But we can isolate this fungus from the beetles, we can isolate it from the cankers, from the galleries, and just about anywhere where you get discoloration. Top right-hand corner, this is a Juglans heinzii sample. You can see the fungus fruiting in the larval gallery. On the bottom right, this is a picture where Curtis pulled a beetle out of a gallery. You can see the Geosmithia fruiting on the elytra. This was a dead beetle, of course. And then here's a picture from Andy. I believe that's the elytra. And you can see the spores. And I'm pretty sure this is Geosmithia because you can tell that those spores are barrel-shaped. So there are plenty of spores on the body of these beetles. The problem in diagnosing this is that the cankers are not visible, at least without shaving the outer bark off. So if you go up to a tree that's just showing flagging, you're not going to see these open-faced cankers. That's atypical for most canker diseases. In the upper right-hand picture, there's a gallery there, and you can see a bit of cracking surrounding that beetle entrance. And that's about all you're going to see without shaving the bark off. If you shave the bark off on the lower right hand, you can see the discoloration. And then you can see the number of hits that occur on larger size branches. The number of hits on these trees is just enormous. You've got to be careful when diagnosing this because the cankers are in the phloem. They often don't extend down into the cambium. So if you're shaving the bark off and you're not careful, you'll shave right through the canker. And when you get down to the cambium, you won't see any discoloration at all. So be very careful in diagnosing this because you've got to be careful how you shave that bark off the tree. This fungus is not a vascular pathogen. In the lower left-hand corner, here's where we've done our original inoculations. Those are black walnut twigs. What we did is we cut a notch and inserted a piece of the fungus and then sealed that flap. And you can see how the canker has formed. That's after 8 weeks. It doesn't look like much, but that's very difficult to do with canker fungi. Most cankers, you have to stress the host really to induce these cankers. With the Geosmithia, it just takes off. It's very aggressive. We've also tried to, Curtis has tried some stab inoculations, and when you stab into the wood, we don't get any kind of development. So it doesn't like to be in that xylem tissue, and it will not spread in the xylem as far as we can tell. So it's primarily a phloem cambium pathogen. Andy kind of mentioned this. I'll put this up here. This fungus has been worked on primarily in Europe, and it's associated with a number of insect hosts. I hope I have them all spelled correctly there. Perhaps not. But a lot of scolitids. If you look down, there's also some ambrosia beetles listed here. So there's a wide range of insects that are associated with, or the Geosmithia is associated with a wide range of insects. This brings up a number of points. First of all, it worries me because if this Geosmithia happened to be something that was introduced from, let's say, Europe or someplace else, we still have potential for many more of these Geosmithias to come in on exotic beetles that may also be potential threats. So we've got to be worried about the introduction of these insects as well as their fungal associates. One of the comments questions that I had is, could this have been a situation where the Geosmithia jumped hosts? It jumped from one beetle to another and then somehow got mixed in with black walnut. And that's a possibility because some of these ambrosia beetles will go to walnut, and the ambrosia beetles can carry the Geosmithia. So there may be some mixing going on, and that may support Steve's thought that this is an exotic introduction. Only time will tell on that. I've got Scolytus chevirevi highlighted there because I had a question about could this Geosmithia have been brought in by Scolytus chevirevi. So the first thing I did is I went out and collected some Scolytus chevirevi, plated it out, and sure enough I got Geosmithia out of it. It turns out it's not the same one, but it's carrying the fungus. We know very little about the Geosmithia associated with beetles here in North America. A pathologist can't go through a talk without showing one of these diagrams. And so this is the work that was done by Miroslav Kolarik. We sent him some isolates, and he's placing, I don't know if you can see, it says Colorado juglans between the blue and the yellow. It looks as if this Geosmithia that is attacking walnut is going to be a new species. It's not aligning itself with any of the European isolates. And I'm pretty confident it's going to be something new. I'm going to let Miroslav actually name the fungus. I got to name the disease so he can name the fungus. Whitney was talking about this orientation and the cankers, and I want to come back to these trunk cankers. And Curtis and I and Whitney have observed these long vertical cankers on the trunk and trying to figure out what's going on there. These galleries are not evenly distributed either on the branches or the trunk. More damage on the lower portion of the branches, and I think Andy may have mentioned this as well. And we see more damage on one side of the trunk, and typically it's on the west side of the tree. And I don't fully understand that. There must be a preference for the beetle to attack one side of the tree. And in these long vertical trunk cankers, the wood and the bark tends to be much more macerated than surrounding individual lesions, and I'm not quite sure why that is as well, but this is a characteristic that we've seen. And almost all the trees that we peel, we see this long streaking occurring on one side. In the lower left-hand corner, I don't know if you can tell, but I've got two white arrows, and if you follow the upper white arrow and then go clockwise around, about three-quarters of the circumference of that walnut, the cambium has been killed. And that's very typical what we see in the late stages of this 1,000 cankers, is that eventually that the trunk, the cambium collapses and dies, and it becomes completely macerated. Now that is loaded, just absolutely loaded, with Geosmithia and the walnut twig beetle. And whether this is a situation where the adults are congregating in that trunk to overwinter or what's happening, I don't know. But basically that whole area is just colonized with the Geosmithia. But from the margins, we can also isolate this Fusarium solani. So we know that the Fusarium is part of it. And I have worked with this Fusarium in the past, and these Fusaria are associated with these long vertical trunk cankers on black walnut. And they're also associated with bark beetles. But the Fusarium is not nearly as aggressive as the Geosmithia. These pictures are not at the same magnification, so it looks like the upper picture is larger, but if you look at the scale, it's really quite a bit smaller. And so the Fusarium solani is not as aggressive as the Geosmithia, and I think it plays at best a minor role in the development of this disease. So what about other species? And here I'm getting way out on a limb, but I'll show you some images that Curtis took. We've sort of figured out what was going on in March, and by that time it was really late to get plant material in, so we scrambled to try to find trees on campus to inoculate. We were running around and everywhere trying to find trees, and we ordered from commercial nurseries, and we ordered pecans, and they send us filberts, and you know how it goes. It was a mess. So we're going to have to repeat this. Here's an example of some inoculations that we did on Juglans microcarpa. This is a concern because this could be a bridge species. And the scale on the left, the bottom twig there was inoculated. The one above it was a control, then another inoculated, and then it goes on like that. And what I'm trying to point out here is that we see canker development on Juglans microcarpa, but it's not nearly as aggressive on that species as black walnut. This isn't the best picture, Curtis, but yeah. But here's an example of pecan at the very bottom. We only had one pecan seedling to work with, and based on this one tree, which is kind of hate to even show you this, it looks like pecan's going to be very resistant. English walnut is at the top, and this was late in the season, so I don't put a whole lot of stock in this, but based on the reactions of English walnut from what we've done, it's going to be fairly resistant, I believe. Having said that, and this picture is a bit fuzzy as well. I took this off a PDF, but here's an example in Utah where the two trees on the left are black walnut, the tree on the right is English walnut, and you can see that there's hardly any damage to the English walnut. We do have a couple stray English walnuts in Colorado, and here is an example of an English walnut in the town of Westminster being hit by the walnut twig beetle. This tree was just getting clobbered. You peel the bark off and there are cankers forming around the galleries. This looks pretty bad, but I still think this is a resistant reaction. Those cankers tend to be a little bit more superficial than what we see on black walnut. All right. And I know this is preliminary, but I'm giving you my best guess on the susceptibility of these trees, and we certainly need to do a lot more work. I've listed them here I've got what we call field isolations, where we've have successfully isolated the fungus from samples that have come in, and we see it on Juglans californica. We have not recovered it from Allantifolia. Heinzii major and Nigra and Regia, we've recovered the fungus from all those. And I think most of the other Juglans are going to be either slightly to moderately resistant or susceptible to this disease. And certainly the main threat that I see right now is black walnut. And this sort of summarizes what we've found so far. Based on the rapid mortality that we have seen in Colorado and what's been reported in Utah and Idaho, I think this thing is really nasty, and we've got to be on the lookout for it. The results out of Oregon are a little bit more equivocal, because they are not seeing the rapid decline of black walnut that we've seen here in Colorado. And I think that may be because a lot of those trees in Oregon are hybrids between Juglans heinzii and Juglans nigra. So the development on those trees is a bit slower. But again, the summary, at least in my opinion, is that this poses a very grave risk to black walnut. Okay, that's what I've got.
Just say, Ned, that what you were saying about English walnut, I think we can echo California in that plantation in Winters that Chuck was talking about. If you go down the rows there, you see the disease in eastern black walnut, you see it in the two California native species. Rarely see it in the English walnut, though we found a couple of stems with very similar pattern to what you showed there, lots of attacks, but it looks like it's a resistance type reaction. I guess I'd argue that the California walnuts are not moderately susceptible. I think they're fairly susceptible. We see quite a bit of mortality in native areas as well as in that arboretum. But we're doing all the comparisons there in the lab, and it's we're doing them all side by side. Anyone else have a final question or thought? Yeah. Barb?
So, Wade, you said that there's not other Geosmithias in the U.S.
Yeah, the question, are there other Geosmithias in the United States? And yes, there are some that have been reported from North America. The Geosmithias have been isolated from other substrates rather than just from insects, and so they've been reported from other substrates. But this is really the first report of a Geosmithia associated with an insect. Right. All the Geosmithias that have been reported so far, none have been shown to be pathogenic to trees. And the one that we've got here doesn't match up with the at least so far, with any of the named Geosmithia species in Europe. Okay, the question is, where do I think the Geosmithia came from? And Whitney went down to Arizona and collected beetles from Arizona walnut and also some twigs, and we isolated the fungus from the twigs of the Arizona walnut, but yet it was not causing any major damage. And so that might argue that the beetle is native to Arizona walnut, and the fungus is a native associated with the beetle. That doesn't prove it. It could just mean that the Arizona walnut is resistant. So what we're trying to do is get a much broader sweep of Arizona walnut and see what's going on down there. And we also need to do a better job of comparing what we have here in North America with what's present in Europe. We just found this fungus about 9 months ago, so a lot of this is preliminary. We need a lot more in-depth research on it. So I don't know. I have a hard time believing that this fungus is native to Arizona and just suddenly moved, like the Big Bang Theory, up and became a problem. My gut feeling is that it's probably an invasive. But either Whitney's right or I'm right. We'll find out.
How does it cause the canker?
The question is, how does the geosmithia cause a canker? You mean?
How does it grow throughout the wood? You know, does it clog the
wall? I assume it has macerating enzymes that degrades the tissue, but whether, you know, the process by which that happens, I have no idea. At least not yet.
Because the other geosmithia don't, that's why I was wondering if this one
right.
Is different.
Don't know.
Any other questions or comments, thoughts? Right, thank you, Ed.
So by virtue of your bug tie, Ned, we're going to give you an honorary entomological kudo today for coming to our meeting. I want to thank all four of the speakers for coming on short notice. This was, as I said early on, a late-breaking symposium, so we put an application in early to mid-October and told everybody you got to come to Reno. And luckily, Andy and Whitney and I were going to be here, and we just had to get Ned and Chuck to come, so it worked out quite well. I'm going to spend a couple minutes just summarizing what we heard today and talk about some of the future directions and areas that I think this symposium has pointed us in. First of all, we need to do an expanded survey of the Western and Great Plains areas, particularly these transition zones that Whitney was talking about that lead in the riparian areas east from Colorado and into the eastern U.S. because, as everyone said, there's 2,000-pound gorillas out there. One is the commercial industry in California, and the other is eastern black walnut and the timber and nut production there. Secondly, we need more work on fungal identification and phylogeny, and luckily Milos Kalerik, or whatever his name is coming to Davis this winter, and we're going to hope to pigeonhole him and get more information out of him about the fungus. And obviously we need some studies on the vectoring and transmission of the fungus by the beetle, particularly as Whitney and Ned alluded to, this overwintering biology and the etiology of the canker formation in the main stem. That's quite interesting, and I think we need to look at that. As Andy pointed out, development of an attractive bait or repellents would be very useful. I know the EDRR program is interested in being able to detect this insect using traps, and frankly, our ethanol-baited traps are kind of marginal, at least at this point. I think we need to more clearly establish the risk and the threat to the commercial walnut production, as well as the risk to our germplasm collections, like in Winters or the butternut collection in Corvallis, and Chuck had raised that point. And Chuck also raised the potential interactions of this beetle disease complex with our existing insects and diseases in walnut. How are they interacting? And are we going to see both types or multiple types of diseases in trees in the future? And lastly, Whitney brought up the point of developing viable insecticide treatments for this beetle. Homeowners and landowners are going to be probably spraying and treating to try to maintain the health and vigor of their trees. And obviously, we need some research in that area. So those are just some discussion points I thought as I was going through this, and I guess we'll end with that. I'll leave you with those seeds. For me, it's been really exciting to have this symposium. This is one of these examples I was talking about at lunch. You feel like an ambulance chaser. The next problem that comes the way, you drop everything else and run after it. And literally, we started working on this in June and July. And these types of things are facing research scientists every year now. Something new comes along, and if you are working on invasive species, you really have to devote your laboratory energy and time to those new problems. So to some extent, it causes us to be more flexible because these problems don't go away, and there always seem to be new ones coming. Okay, well, I just want to thank all the speakers. Give them a round of applause. And I thank...